By 2050, everybody needs to produce whatever it is they're producing with net zero emissions. The building environment accounts for 40% of the world's energy-related carbon dioxide emissions. Can we really bring them to net zero?
Welcome to Renewable Future from the renewable materials company Stora Enso.
To me, it seems like an impossible ask. Every raw material in the world needs energy to be harvested or extracted from the earth and then developed into usable elements and then constructed. And then there's the lifetime of the building. And what do you do with all the material when the building is no longer needed? All of that creates emissions. Even with wood as the raw material, where forests are absorbing CO2, this certainly helps with reaching net zero, but still, is it really possible to create a building with net zero emissions?
Yes, it is possible.
Christina Gamboa, head of the World Green Building Council.
However, change is not at the pace and scale needed to be in line with the Paris Agreement and making sure we keep 1.5 degrees Celsius degree scenario within reach. We're already at 1.2 of global warming. So there's a lot to be done there. But in terms of possibility, what I see is that there's already examples, great examples of climate action around the globe. And we need to match that up with greater ambition and action from all stakeholders at the same level. Because right now what happens is there are the solutions, but we're not in sync. And that's causing these issues. I think there's no doubt we know how to design and build to net zero, but it must become the norm. And that means tackling both operational and embodied whole life carbon to deliver that systemic and transformational change, right? And so the leadership from bolder regulation is going to be also particularly key.
So what does she mean by getting everyone in sync? And how do you do it?
Oh, yes, it's very key, because in that whole life carbon vision, that means we're also bringing up front all the elements of the life cycle, from the design phase, right, to the construction phase, to the operational and the end of life. And so if we go to those building blocks of how we get to these products, right, that are buildings that are a little bit immobile by essence,
yeah,
but eventually they are made up of many components. And then that's also the idea of coming in sync. What do I mean by that? Buildings have been designed usually using like a lineal way of thinking. Like people design and then they off you go and the responsibility is eroded. And actually, we need a different mindset in order to be making sure that at the design phase and the construction phase, buildings use materials and products with circular properties. Of course, low carbon is like check, right? That's, I don't have to convince you that's now an imperative.
Yeah.
But the circular properties, both in conventional and alternative materials, will mean that we will have assets that don't contain harmful toxins. They're minimizing natural resource depletion, or let's say designing out waste also from the buildings, and that materials are renewable and can also include secondary materials. And that concept means recovered and reusable materials. So at World GBC, we did recently a work called the Circular Built Environment Playbook. And over 2 years, we did like a baseline. Where are we and where do we need to go? We demonstrate that materials can still be in good condition even after 30 years of being used. So the concept of sufficiency, of questioning, do we have to knock it down or can we reuse? Making sure that we have the traceability, the passports of the materials in check, then we can actually change how we think of buildings in this space. Designers in particular, I think, are very well placed to challenge the business as usual approaches and unleash really forward-looking designs that consider the entire life cycle of the asset. And that's a call to action we're doing. And I would say we need to challenge short-term thinking, get away from the lineal thinking, take a longer-term view, because we have to consider past, present, and future of building products and components. And that means actually we can design for reuse over multiple lifetimes. And that maintenance will bring higher value to everyone. And of course, there's a designed for disassembly and deconstruction. That means material banks, eliminating waste, and making sure that we help the retrofit economy we need to be building quickly. Because, as I said, I think the key thing is, beyond the low carbon, is designing out waste from the system and making sure we're embracing those circular properties.
There must be, though, a real challenge for a designer, or maybe it's exciting, I don't know, but just to start designing a building with the thought that this building could be reused in 50 years' time for another building, and that, you know, that there will be nothing left to waste, that every other part can, you know, can be used again. I mean, it seems like a huge mindset shift.
Yeah, but that's why World GPC is partnering with many organizations to do this. In the playbook, there's plenty of examples of that happening. And yeah. But I hear also it kicks in that, why are you not doing this? And so we see some stakeholders that are not doing this because they, unfortunately, there's still a very conservative side of the buildings and construction sector that is just waiting for mandatory things to deliver the business case for circularity, which actually is quite strong, but they're not seeing it. Some people, let's say, if you've done the same thing for so many decades, why change? So it's a resistance to innovation. And in a sector that can deliver a lot of innovation, then here's where the collaboration with policymakers kicks in. Because where we can make the most difference, even for the disassembly, is actually at the policy and design stage, where we can crucially have mandatory requirements for circularity and whole life carbon, tightening construction product data requirements around circularity. Right now, we have no more environmental product declarations, but we should be having minimum thresholds of reusability and recyclability, and go even at the ambitious level of introducing landfill bans and incineration bans for construction products. If you have those bans, then you will find that what you thought was waste has value. And then with the information and transparency, we will create that circular economy of for materials.
And what you're saying as well, then, is if you put those regulations in place, because they sound fairly stringent, but that the technology is there and the solutions are there to make this work.
Exactly. And it might sound stringent, but actually, this is something also I can explain like an ambition loop. What we have done at World GPC, and we do with leading businesses, is show the vision of the possible and demonstrate that there is a business case for all of this. We have a minimum, let's say, of movement in this area, and it is happening, and we have demonstrated it. But to mainstream, that's where the governments have to see that the business sector is willing to do that, that there's evidence that is possible, and then work with businesses in a way that is, let's say, we bring them in the journey, right, to get to a moment where we get to those bands. So we start with the thresholds, we build them up, and then eventually we will see that those bands will create, for example, more space for us to conserve land, for biodiversity, and all those things that also are so systemically interconnected. It's not just one sector thing. It just, like, say, spills over in effects across many things. So it's just... It's so promising.
Gamboa then sees a huge opportunity in the design phase. If we get it right here, it can affect every other part of the building's lifetime. Now, that's either very scary, high pressure for a designer, or very exciting, depending on who you are. We spoke to one.
My name is Alan Organsky. I am principal and director at Gray Organsky Architecture, and I am the director of the Innovation Labs at Bauhaus Earth in Berlin, Germany.
Alan Organsky is one of the world's leading designers in bio-based and regenerative building. For him, this is exciting, but it sounds like it's also keeping him awake at night.
If you think about how much building we're going to produce in the next 30 years, you know, that narrow window for climate action before we crash through the 2-degree Celsius temperature guardrail.
Sure.
You start to think that there's more potential there than in many, many sectors. And moreover, if we can create this important synergy between natural systems, wetlands, polluted cultures, forests, silvicultures, I think we start to imagine that we can begin to store carbon and serve as really one of the only forces at a massive scale to not only mitigate carbon emissions, but actually reverse carbon emissions, to start to absorb carbon through the synergy and the symbiosis of forests and buildings, for example.
Now, to do this, it seems, though, I mean, you would need every part of the industry to be on board and working in harmony to make this happen. Is that really realistic? I mean, can you make this happen?
I think we can start to adapt our behaviors, and it really depends how well we understand and can assess the stakes of no action. I do think there's already, you start to see a movement in you know, companies like Stora Enso, where they're really focusing on internalizing what were formerly economic externalities, you know, the degradation of the natural world, the emission of, you know, the sort of concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that are creating real economic challenges, but they weren't really part of our economic calculus. So there's economic incentive, then there's political will, and then there's just a set of, I don't know, almost transdisciplinary behaviors that we start to adopt. You start seeing interdisciplinary explorations going on in research between sectors that never spoke to one another. In industry, we see industrial leaders trying to bring in consultants from fields that wouldn't typically be part of their remit. I think the mechanisms are available to us, but I think we're not well versed in them. We don't really have sufficiently and deeply informed scientific education around these topics. You know, I come out of the design world, so, you know, I would love my students and my colleagues in the field to really understand the systemic implications of the decisions they make around material specification or a labor force that they might engage, where they build, whether they should build there. These kinds of questions can only be informed by quantitative information as well as qualitative assessment.
But then it sounds like you're beginning to see this happening, but it's just not structured in any particular way today.
Well, I mean, there's certain kinds of levers that I've seen, you know, in the time that I've been researching, for example, this bio-based building approach to dense urban building, concentrated accretions of material through the act of building, where we look at, you know, buildings as a potential carbon storage system rather than as a source of emissions. And, you know, what happened was that the sort of experiments of some Austrians looking at mass timber systems to apply to single family houses in a sort of prefabricated methodology suddenly being adopted as a means to build high-rise buildings. And that's evolved rapidly over the 10 years that we started looking at this. And, you know, so to me, I start to see that change can happen rapidly because some kind of product or opportunity avails itself. And then I start worrying about the collateral damage that might come out of it too. And that's a whole other discussion. But I would say we've seen signs of major change. We saw the steel and concrete industries over the course of the 20th century evolve really rapidly once they found a suitable application. And what we just didn't do with that is understand at that time the environmental impacts and the sort of that would be unleashed by that revolution. So we have to be, you know, really ambitious, but we have to be extremely cautious at the same time.
From what you're saying, it sounds to me that, you know, if we can use bio-based products to construct our buildings, then we've kind of solved the problem, but there could potentially be other problems at the back end of that we're not thinking about. So, or maybe you've thought about those potential problems.
Yeah, more than thought, I've worried about them. I guess what I'd say is that, you know, in our embracing the idea that buildings can store carbon and that we can use things like timber and engineered timber systems to build dense cities that we'll inevitably have to build anyway, they're a kind of sunk cost. We have to build cities for 2.3 billion people, right, in the next 30 years. That's exciting. It presents an exciting almost arithmetic proposition, which is that, oh, we can amass huge amounts of carbon and store them in these very durable consumer products, our buildings. The downside is that we could turn the timber industry back into just one more extractive industry, which doesn't care about anything but scaling and finding more and more material without really assessing the associated consequences that come from that extractive process. Now that we've shown that we can build big buildings using these materials. And they were finding different ways to layer bio-based materials into the building enclosure and envelope and structure. Now we have to think really hard about what it is we're calling upon, what resources we're calling upon and their impacts. And so we start to, we're looking right now at the possibility that a whole host of kinds of fiber, we'll say, come out of forests as one example of a landscape that we might draw upon through natural disturbance, mortality of the forest, or specific management techniques that are geared to actually supporting forest health. So it might be invasive species mitigation measures by foresters. It might be water quality improvement measures by foresters. It might include things like trying to actually increase the health, the carbon storage capacity of forests by the kinds of systemic measures we take. Or we might even say that, you know, we're going to manage a forest to enhance biodiversity, which is a sort of holy grail. In doing that, we're going to produce a bunch of fiber. We're going to take what are already disturbed forests and we're going to try to improve their health. And in so doing, we're going to pull species out of them, which are not necessarily known to manufacturers as a potential material resource. And so we have to learn about that and we have to show people how we can create new structural systems and new products in the building from materials that are coming out of natural forest flux.
And then is there collateral damage on the other end of the scale after a building is no longer in use or in need?
Well, that's the really critical point, and I'm really glad you raised it. You know, we're going to have to start to develop scenarios for the use of building materials at the end of a building's life. So we have to actually make our buildings true contributors to a circular economy. You know, wood products, for example, are really interesting because they come out of the biosphere and they're moved through industrial processes into the technosphere. And then they become waste. At least that's how we consider them in life cycle assessment. Yeah. That at the end of the building's life, the wood is going to be thrown away, right? And it's going to be landfilled or burned for energy, and it's going to re-emit its carbon. And so wood, in that scenario, is entirely carbon neutral. It is carbon positive only for the length of a single building's lifespan. Yeah. If we can develop scenarios for the reuse of wood and we can start using techniques of design for disassembly and reuse, where architects and engineers and builders are saying, yes, we're putting these materials in this very explicit way. They're legible connection systems that can be demounted. We can then take this large format piece of cross-laminated timber or glue lam or some other material and place it as a kind of new product or raw material for reuse in the building sector. Again, so we can create carbon storages that will last across multiple building life cycles. And that's a really important thing to do because, right, otherwise there's no incentive to do anything but extract material from the forest. So we have to create the right safeguards in the forest and we have to develop the right scenarios for how to build with reused wood and other materials. I'll just say that right now, I think the way the building economy works is that buildings will be potentially absorbers of waste. They will be the engines of circular economic activity because they can take waste and absorb it into new kinds of products. In 40, 50, 60, 70 years, if that becomes the length of a building a lifespan, those buildings will become the material banks for future building and other hopefully durable consumer products. But primarily, we know the builders know the building sector. We know what kinds of needs it will have, and we can position the materials that we put into buildings as part of that circular economic cycle.
All our interviewees today have talked about retrofitting and the reuse of building parts. Christina Gamboa talked earlier about a passport system where every building block is accounted for and stored in a database so that it could be reused later on. If you want to know more about this, check out our podcast on how digital solutions are making the construction industry more sustainable. Or listen to this man, Heinz Felder. He's the Senior Vice President of Group Technology and Investments at Stora Enso.
Imagine that you not only build a house, but that you have a possibility to really record, and this is now happening, what is the so-called building pass, which contains all the materials being used in a house. So you have a true inventory, which ideally allows you then after the first use of the house, instead of demolishing it, that you could reuse certain parts. Why not reuse windows, reuse doors, even frames, wooden frames, and build then a new house? And that's how you could lengthen then the lifetime of the wood products.
And is Stora Enso working on you know, like mass engineered elements today that could then be reused? I'm even thinking like walls and floors. Is there a way of, you know, reusing those then?
Absolutely. In different areas, so we have, I think we were the first to develop what is called cross-laminated timber, CLT. We were also those who brought then LVL from the US here to Europe. It has a couple of advantages. So you make best use of the wood. Number one, you optimize really the strength properties. Number two, and it also allows you this production process then to make, for instance, wall frames, which are super large. They can be like 10, 15 meters wide, 3-4 meters high, which allows you then a wooden building. It's like a Lego, a set of Lego pieces. You put it together in a couple of days. Right. And of course, it allows also for a light construction.
And then theoretically, those Lego pieces could be reused for another building then further down the road, as long as the quality has remained after those 50 to 80 years.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. Yeah. But you need to have the good inventory right from the beginning.
Christina Gamboa also mentioned that there are loads of examples out there. She gives us a few.
There's a global firm called Schneider Electric. They signed our net zero carbon buildings commitment. And so in alignment with that commitment, Schneider Electric has recently completed and moved to a new flagship building, Intensity, it's called. And they have achieved significant steps in energy efficiency and on-site generation. And the building is a fantastic example of also reducing embodied carbon emissions across the life cycle. SOM moved also, for example, to a new San Mateo County headquarters. It's the first net zero energy civic building constructed with mass timber in the U.S., and it achieved 85% reduction in structural embodied carbon. It's amazing. And there's a group in Australia, which is an industry leader, GPT Group, and they achieved upfront embodied carbon neutral certification for a Melbourne logistics development through a Green Building Council of Australia and Climate Active. So it's doable.
In 2019, Alan Organski designed an ecological living module at the request of the UN. They wanted to show what a low-carbon alternative living area could look like.
Where we really tried to track every single impact, every single carbon molecule that would be emitted from a building. And, you know, what we found was that we did pretty well. I mean, we had the environmental control systems that were really optimizing ecosystem services. We had the right materials that were had low impact, but we were trucking them in from distant locations. And so we were starting, what we see is the possibility and we see the gaps. And I think it's our job right now to really clarify and expose the gaps that we could fall into, and not celebrate successes and talk about net zero buildings. What we really need to see is where the failures happen and how to mitigate those so that we can make the benefits of, say, carbon storage in buildings really do the work we want it to do.
So can we do it? Net zero by 2050?
I have my optimism is always there, but it's tempered. As a really close colleague of mine from Finland once said, well, you know, we had the technological expertise to get us into this problem. So maybe we can use that same sort of technological expertise to get us out of it.
Christina Gamboa.
Our mantra is that the solutions exist. We need scale. And we need also to make sure that all the new sustainable finance levers and mechanisms and the transparent data sharing, there's accurate benchmark targets that are true and accountable. And then all of this accelerated in an ecosystem of the policies that each country requires for delivering social value, equity, and do a waste with risk, and also all this disproportionate negative impacts of having, let's say, low quality assets around the world.
You've been listening to Renewable Future from the Renewable Materials Company, Stora Enso.
We'd love to hear your feedback and ideas for new programs or any comments you may have. Mail to podcast@storaenso.com.